Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 86, recorded September 9th, 2010. Zakate crushes Adam. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Carbonite Pro. With prices starting at $10 a month, all of your office PCs can be backed up safely and automatically. For a free trial and to learn more, visit CarbonitePro.com. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware. I'm Ryan Trout, joined by Patrick Norton again. Hello, Patrick. How are you this
week? I'm good, man. I'm very good. I've been ripping disks and using that as an excuse to upgrade to ridiculous amounts of hardware.
Hey, anytime you can find an excuse, right? That's really kind of the mentality you have to have in this business, especially if you see hardware all the time, right? It's kind of like if you really wanted to, you could upgrade every day and add something new or take something out, and you probably don't want to end up doing that. But so what are you said you were building a like super high performance Ripper machine.
I think it's going to end up being called the Rip Monster 3000.
Nice.
So I have this ridiculous collection of CDs I had completely ripped a while back, did some partial attempts to re-rip them, and finally I'm like, okay, I'm getting everything on the new media server that I'm running at home. So EAC, it's kind of like the standard. It's free. It does what they call secure ripping, which basically means it does the most accurate rip of the data possible. And I prefer DB PowerAmp, which is a paid program, because if you buy the $36 version of it, the reference version, it comes with something called the Batch Ripper. Batch Ripper is really amazing because it was designed for, you ever see like the, you know, automated CD burner reader devices where you basically put a stack of CDs and it'll go through and either rip or burn that stack of CDs or DVDs? What you can do with Batch Ripper is you can run, I think, up to 6. I'm not sure if it'll handle 7, but I'll know that later this week. You can handle up to like 6 CD, basically rip up to 6 discs at a time. So I had my Blu-ray drive, a second internal IDE drive, a Blu-ray drive on SATA, an IDE drive, 2 more SATA DVD drives ripping, plus an external Blu-ray drive, one of the new Plex Store drives over a USB. And I was averaging about 60 drives an hour. And for anybody who's like an audio freak, yes, I was doing what they call secure rips, which is there's burst mode, which allows the internal software on the CD-ROM to basically skip over defects, right? Defects happen in the data. They can be manufacturing defects. They can be scratches. They can be some oddity in the aluminum layer, which I actually found a disc I have that was literally fresh out of the case, but I couldn't get an accurate rip on it according to Accurate Rip, which is a software feature that you can employ in DB PowerAmp. So basically there's this database of what the information should look like checksum style information for the CD that you're ripping, and you can compare your rip versus that, and if it matches, then you have a accurate rip. So in this case, like, there's a brand new disc out of the box, you know, shrink wrapped, had just been ripped off, but I couldn't get an accurate rip. And I finally, by twisting the CD in the air, I could see this sort of strange sort of, it's like silver and then a dark gray sort of stripe through the corner. So apparently there's a manufacturing defect on the disc, which actually happens. So, but you can basically engage what C2 mode, which is an advanced form of secure ripping. But I'm hoping, because I picked up 3 more DVD burners, like I picked up 3 of light on burners, and I've been using the Blackbird case that I recycled, which, you know, I mean, it's a beautiful case. It's got built-in water cooling. You know, it looks like something like a Cylon mated with a, you know, Edsel or something like that, which I actually happen to like the look, despite the 2 horrible images I just brought to mind. But it weighs like 70 pounds, and I'm constantly taking it from work to home and home to work. So I got a, you know, a big old 900 class Antec case. The one I wanted, they actually had one that in the store that had a handle on the top. And the coolest thing I've ever seen, I've got to look up the name of this case again. They had a cutaway behind where the CPU mounts. I say a cutaway behind where the CPU mounts on the motherboard. So you could, you know, you basically open up the backside of the case and you would have access to the backside of, you know, the mount that holds your cooler down on the motherboard. It actually allows you to change coolers without having to pull the motherboard out of the case.
That is one of the coolest features on newer cases. The first one I saw that did that was the Corsair 800D, and it was a panel probably, you know, it was a good size panel on the back of the case that would come off behind that back door so that you could add water cooling. You could change, you know, because the default stock Intel coolers, you know, those snap into place and you can take those off and remove them without having to access the back of the motherboard. Most of the high-end options require you to have access to the back of the motherboard, which I've had this happen many times. I'm sure you have as well. hence your appreciation for that feature. It's like, well, I want to change the cooler on this, but now I have to take out all the video cards, all the other accessories. I have to take the motherboard out of the case. And it's just like basically like ripping your entire system apart and putting it back together.
I always hear people like, I saw your test bed that you're using for insert name of testing something, and it's a motherboard sitting on the table with a power supply next to it. You know, why don't you use insert name of cool guy case at this point?
Sure.
And it's like, because once you've, the first 400 times you've, pulled apart your entire system to put something in it, all of a sudden, like a silly thing like that little open space. So I think I'm going to saw that space with a Dremel tool in the bottom of this case when I build it. But the Antec, I ended up with another Antec 900 too. The first one I had lasted forever until somebody used it in our workshop behind our studio as a step stool and bent the case approximately an inch offline this way. at which case it became very difficult to close and looked a little, you know what I mean? It looked like that.
Yeah.
That 79 Camaro somebody's been sitting on in their front yard for too long. So I retired that case, moved everything into that Blackbird. But it's amazing. Like, actually, nobody builds, I shouldn't say nobody builds it. It's pretty rare, actually, to find a case that has more than three optical drive bays, because, who in their right mind wants more than three optical drive bays? Obviously me. So the 900, I think, has, you can configure it with like eight if you pull out the front, eight or nine if you pull out the front bay.
Oh, wow.
And before anybody emails, I know that there are CD duplicator cases where you can have like five or six, 5 1/4 inch optical drives in an eSATA case with power, which if I could have found one in Northern California, I would have gotten, but I wanted the immediate gratification of building my Rip Monster 4000 now instead of doing the smart thing, which would have been buying like an Antec P180, one of their quiet towers, and then waiting for the $70 CD duplicator mini tower to show up. So
now is an important thing for people like us. The idea of now is very important for people like us, Patrick. It's just like, it's bad. It's bad for me where I live in the Cincinnati area. We don't have fries and that kind of stuff. So my selection of like today now is pretty limited. So I have a lot of overnight shipping now type of stuff that happens for me.
That's so really expensive.
It does. So we want to talk about a couple of news items here before we jump into a whole host of emails and questions that you guys have sent in. The first one is, we talk a lot about APUs and Fusion and Sandy Bridge and all these types of processor technologies that are merging between the CPU and the GPU. Intel has obviously, they've started shipping combined CPU-GPU processors quite a while ago. The Core i5, i3 series of parts. Excuse me, the Linfield CPUs, not Linfield, Clarkdale, are CPU and GPU on the same chip, but not, they aren't the same die. So they're on the same substrate, but you get integrated graphics on that way. Also, the Pine Trail Atom variant is a CPU-GPU combined option. And AMD's actually been talking about CPU-GPU combined processors for longer than Intel, but they still don't have one out. But they are getting very close, which is good. The first one, we've talked about them in a generic sense for a while. The Ontario part is going to be the first one that AMD releases. And we've also now got some information about another one called Zacate that is based on the same architecture, the same Bobcat core, but they're aimed at different markets. What's interesting about this, I won't go into a whole lot of the details. Josh Walrath, who's one of the writers at PC Perspective, wrote up a really good piece that talks about all the different TDPs of these different settings, how they may or may not compare to what the Intel Atom is today, what the Intel Atom is tomorrow, basic core i3 processors, that types of thing. Because right now we're still kind of guessing on frequencies and stuff. But right. what was interesting that came out was AMD basically talked a little bit about the thermal limits of these processors. And the basic Ontario is going to have a stated TDP, which is thermal dissipation something. Basically, it's like the thermal limit of the part. This is the wattage that a system designer has to plan for. So that kind of determines how much power they use and how small a system they can go in, et cetera, et cetera.
The thermal envelope.
Exactly.
The amount of heat a particular case or fan combination or primarily a notebook or a small PC can dissipate before everything starts to fry inside of it.
Which is bad. Which would be bad. So this is starting at 9 watts, which is pretty low. And the higher end part will actually come out at about 19 watts as a Zacate. But what's interesting about that 9 watt part is, let me find this other number here, is that the 9 watt Ontario will be going up against 10 to 12 watt Atom parts that exist today. Now, we don't know what Intel has planned for, beginning part of 2011. Yeah, we'll find out next week, I think, at the Intel Developer Forum in San Francisco. But the kind of overall scheme here is that Intel or the AMD has made a very, very powerful part integrating a DirectX 11 capable GPU. Obviously, a slower one compared to what we're all used to seeing, but a DX11 feature-matched GPU with a Bobcat core, which is a completely new architecture from AMD, for under 9 watts, which is
that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. And the Zacate is going to be – it'll be a little bit larger die. It'll be – the GPU will be running a little bit faster. I think we might have more shader processors in that. And that's going to run it up 19 watts TDP, which still puts it into the realm of netbook-style laptops. Right. I don't think it's really going to compete against like the Core i5, i3s of today. I think the CPU-GPU performance is going to be lower than that. But it's still... It's in a very unique position where AMD has not, in the last 5, 6, 7 years or so, had a compelling part for these low-end solutions. I mean, you look at the blowing up, how quickly netbooks and tablets, not really tablets, but netbooks have like taken over the mobile world. And every single one of those had an Intel processor in it. That hurts AMD's bottom.
I mean, it's interesting looking at the picture there where it's like a €1 piece. The part looks like it's actually smaller than the Euro piece. Obviously, the Euro piece isn't squared off, but that's pretty wild. You're talking Core 2 Duo power in a just an absolute power sipping package. That makes netbooks really usable, and that's a really great home theater PC part with the DirectX 11 acceleration built into it. I'd be really curious to see how it does. It should have enough oomph on it to unpack Blu-ray with no problem, even do some basic encoding and light 3D gaming. So that'll be fun to see.
It definitely will. It definitely will be able to do that. This is still, the super low-end part. I'm still personally more interested in Llano, the desktop parts that are coming out down the road. But this is good news, that the fact that they were able to do this. Also interesting, this first part is going to be built on TSMC's 40-nanometer process. This will be the first AMD architecture part built outside of AMD's own processing arm, even though that was spun off into GlobalFoundries. They have the ability to go either way, but nobody really expected them to kind of jump away from that very soon, but we expect to see the next iteration of Ontario hitting back to the GlobalFoundries guys as well. So it should be an interesting, very interesting part, and if they can get this out before the end of the year, it could make for, kind of like you're saying, interesting small form factor machines. Be curious to see what it can do with really basic gaming. Obviously, I think we can assume that it will best whatever the Intel HD graphics and the Atom world will do, and go from there. Should be pretty cool.
Hey, have you seen the new Zotac Z-Box designs?
You're talking about the ones with the blue string or the Blu-ray?
The big blue circle on the front of them.
Yeah.
It's if you go to like Zotac USA.com/products/mini-PCs, I think Engadget wrote about it earlier this week. Their Intel Atom D525 boxes, but they have a very unusual design. They're sort of a sloped aluminum back. It's designed to sit there flat or vertical. And DDR2 800 supports 2 or 4 gigabytes of RAM. It's a basic difference between the 34BR and the 33BR in the configuration. But that's another one that's looking like a really good Zotac. If you play around with Atom, if you've ever built an Atom box for a home theater PC, Zotac kind of owns that motherboard market. But this is a really interesting all-in-one design that's kind of slim, elegant, has a space that built into it for a side loader. Yeah, isn't that pretty slick? I mean, imagine that sitting on top of your, you know, whatever particular, you know, whatever stack of media boxes you have or you want to replace. I think that one's got a...
I'm talking about the one that's like a brushed silver on one side and black on the other with blue circle. These actually have integrated blue drives on them too.
Yeah, yeah. I'm curious. I haven't found the pricing on them yet. So the Blu-ray drives have gotten a lot less expensive in the last year. But these, you know, the slot loading Blu-ray drives still come at a pretty healthy premium. But yeah, if you look at the internal configuration, it's a really, really nicely integrated board in terms of how they've got a high flow fan on the underside, decent management of the airflow inside of that. So I'm hoping it's really as quiet as it is sort of svelte looking. They also have a really horrible board that comes inside of it so that if you want to attach it to the back of a monitor, it's set up so it's kind of a snap mount, like a GPS mount, so you can attach it to the back of the monitor if you're into the whole monitor computing. Like the first DIY monitor computer friendly all-in-one PC, which probably makes it a product category of one.
So these, the Z-Box HDs, I guess they call them, those are the ones with Blu-ray. They have Atom processors and NVIDIA Ion chipsets. I think we might have talked about it a couple weeks ago, but they also, some that don't look as good, they don't have the integrated optical drives, but they had Intel CULV processors in them that have a little bit more power into them. Those are also pretty cool. The Zotac has kind of carved out its own little niche for that, and they've done a pretty good job.
Yeah, I think they definitely own that one. But yeah, they're much bigger than the older ones. Oops, sorry.
Yeah. No, I was going to say, we want to bring up one more kind of announcement that came out. This one will be really quick. NVIDIA announced the GeForce 400M series of mobility graphics chips. This will complete the line of everything from the super low-end discrete parts all the way up to the GeForce GTX 480M. These are using new GPUs. If you're familiar with the architectures, you know, GF100 was the GPUs and the desktop versions of the 480 and the 470. Mm-hmm. And then the GF104 was a new die, smaller, more efficient, slightly re-architected. That was used in GTX 460 on the desktop part. That part is actually used on the two high-end parts in the mobility, and then new ones, 106 and 108. Those numbers don't mean a whole lot, but what it does tell us is that NVIDIA has been consistently iterating on their architecture, trying to get it smaller, trying to get it more efficient, trying to make it easier to manufacture. Because one of the things, you know, you can get away with a 250-watt TDP part on a desktop gaming computer, but you aren't going to get anywhere close to that in the mobility world, no matter how big and how many fans your laptop has, unless it's, you know, a 19-inch screen on it, which we've seen a couple of those, unfortunately, then you have to worry about these thermal constraints. So they basically have gone through, updated the line. They've got everything down from the GeForce GT415M that has 48 CUDA cores up to 352 CUDA cores on their highest end part. GDDR5 memory on most of them, DDR3 in the lower end. So these are going to hopefully bring NVIDIA back into the world of getting their chips into some of these mid-range parts. And what their kind of spiel with this, their kind of shtick that they're going after is, you know, when the holiday buying season comes up, there's going to be maybe an HP laptop that doesn't have discrete graphics. It just uses the Intel integrated for $750. And they say you're going to be able to find Acer and Asus machines that have almost identical specs, but include an NVIDIA discrete GPU on it, and for the same amount of money. And they're obviously telling us the benefits of what this is. And thanks to NVIDIA's Optimus technology, which I know we have talked about here before, it's where the operating system and the NVIDIA driver are able to completely disable the discrete GPU when it's not in use. So you don't have to worry about a lot of power consumption issues with that. You're only really using the GPU when you want to use it, or when it will really help performance if you're watching HD video or you're playing a game or, you know, something like that. So it can be a pretty efficient use of power and of space in a laptop. So we'll have to see how these get implemented in there. We've seen the problem with mobility announcements is that we don't get to see them day one. We have to wait for HP and Acer and Asus and Lenovo and all these guys to actually integrate them. Yeah, we have to wait for those. The design cycles are tremendously longer compared to what, you know, putting out a new graphics card upgrade is. So we will be keeping an eye on that.
So it's going to be a while before we know how well these perform. So that's part one. So, you know, when all of these ship later this year. I have a question for you. Why does NVIDIA need 8 SKUs in the mobile area? You know what I mean? Like, it's you know, because you're doing this like CUDA cores, 48, 96, 96, 96, 396 core parts are differentiated with clock speeds from 500 to 650 megahertz, you know, 144 cores, 192 cores. At the high end, the GTX, you know, it's 192 cores, 288 cores, 352 cores. You know, the 192-core device is running at 675 hertz. You know, I mean, I'm looking at the numbers on this, and I'm like, how much of a performance difference is there going to be between, like, the GTX 460 and the 480? And then, obviously, the 415 and the 420 and the 425M are the super low-end parts.
Yeah.
But why are they carrying 8 SKUs? I mean, do they really need all that many different mobile parts?
So I would say not. If you look at the difference, between like the 480, 470, 460 parts, the mobility parts, I think you'll see noticeable performance differences there, going from 352 to 288 to 192 shader processors. Now, the point you brought up is the 420, 425, and 435M parts all have 96 CUDA cores. And the only reason they differ is through their graphics clock, the shader clock, and that's it. So, you've got your 420M runs at 500 megahertz. The 435M runs at 650 megahertz. You know, I can tell you that they probably shouldn't have this, but the reason they do is because their OEMs are asking for these parts. Maybe Acer has a specific TDP for one series of laptops, and they might even have a TDP 10 watts less for another one. It's a little bit slimmer, and they can do that by lowering the frequency 150 megahertz, right?
Okay, so that makes sense.
The shader parts. That keeps those in line. But it also prevents people like us and the media from saying, well, how can you have a 435M at this performance and a 435M at this performance and try to call them the same thing? So it's kind of like maybe the better of two evils,
right?
You know, do we want to have a ton of parts that don't really have a lot of difference, or do you want to introduce any kind of confusion? I think in the end, I don't think any user that listens to our show, or you or me even, is going to say, well, this one's got 420, but this one's got the 425. I think at the end it's going to be like, whatever, between those two, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, so, probably unless you're doing some serious gaming on a notebook, you're probably not really paying attention to the graphics inside of your notebook anyway.
That's true. That's true.
Or you're doing like professional workstation applications.
Yep. All right, now we've got a lot of emails to get to. Before we do that, I want to take a quick moment to thank today's podcast sponsor. This episode of Twitch is brought to you by Carbonite Pro. Business PCs crash all the time. These days, it's mostly because of hard drive failures or viruses, especially if some of your employees are less selective about what they download on their PCs than others. Be sure you keep your business up and running, even if your computers aren't, with Carbonite Pro. Carbonite Pro backs up all of your PCs in your business automatically whenever they're connected to the internet. It's safe. Your files are encrypted before they leave your computer for maximum security. It's easy to use whether you're a computer novice or a full-fledged techie. It's automatic and it's affordable with prices starting at just $10 a month, and you only pay for the amount of backup you actually need and actually use. And it's one account, one monthly bill. Carbonite Pro gives you a centralized dashboard to give you or your administrator a backup status summary of all the computers in your business. And if there's ever a data loss problem, which obviously we hope there's not, but that day will inevitably come for most of us, each employee can access their own backup files themselves. You can be notified and your office can be up and running again with no headaches or time lost. And because all of this data is stored off-site, each person can access their own files from any computer or even their iPhone or BlackBerry with Carbonite's free applications. All this means you get to focus on growing your business and leave the backup to Carbonite Pro. To try Carbonite Pro free for 30 days, all you have to do is go to carbonitepro.com. There's no offer code, nothing else you have to remember other than that URL, carbonitepro.com. And we thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware.
Thanks, Carbonite Pro.
Indeed. So we've got a lot of emails here. Patrick, what do you say we jump into our first one from Stylian?
Stylian. Stylian? Okay. Stylian.
We'll go with that. This is the worst part of this for me, is trying to pronounce everybody's names.
We get into a lot of trouble on that on Techzilla. Stylian writes in, after listening on one of your shows, that the new Fermi-based Quadro cards by NVIDIA are almost identical to the gamer-level cards. I was wondering if it's possible to force applications such as Premiere CS5 to detect a card like a 460 and enable the Mercury playback engine. I know this is possible with previous generation cards like the GTX 260 I currently own and I'm planning to upgrade. Will the performance being fast as using a true Fermi Quadro equivalent? So basically, the dude wants to hack acceleration for CS5 at the least, you know, basically wants to spend less money but still be able to accelerate CS5 like a full-on professional graphics card.
Yes. I think that is an accurate representation of what he's asking. And you know what? To be, you know, we have to play both sides of this. One is, I think it's a very fair question because if I were a student, if I was in school, I mean, hell, if I'm just a normal consumer and I happen to have Adobe CS5 software, you know, as a student, you can get it for $400 or $500. Spending $1,500, $2,000, $2,500 more than that, you can go higher than that with an NVIDIA Quadro card to get the acceleration on it seems kind of really annoying when you look at the specifications and you see that they're identical to GeForce cards, right? There are some differences. You got larger frame buffers. You've got support for ECC memory and some other things like that, perhaps, that do differentiate. The driver stack is a little bit different, but usually that driver stack is only different for specific applications like 3D Studio Max. There's performance drivers for that, or Maya. I know that there used to be the ability to kind of flash the firmware on your GeForce card. This is back in like the GeForce GTX 200s, I believe, into thinking it's a Quadro card. And then obviously the software would completely believe that it was. I have not heard of anything about this with the 400 series yet. I'm sure NVIDIA is doing everything that they possibly can to prevent that from happening, because Quadro cards are a significant portion of their profit margin when it comes right down to it. And I there's no way that I know to do it. He says he currently owns a GeForce GTX 260, wants to upgrade. I would look at Adobe's software, their specifications, because I believe there are at least one or two GeForce cards that are supported for a certain level of features in CS5. I'm not exactly sure which card it is, but I know for Premiere CS Premiere Pro, which is the big deal about GeForce GPU acceleration, and that is that it can support many, many streams of HD content all at once, decoded, encoded, all that kind of stuff. And I think with a Quadro card, it's an unlimited number of tracks that can be accelerated. And I think with a GeForce card, it's like three tracks can be accelerated. So there are some differences like that too. I haven't seen anything else to help him with this. If anybody's listening has any tips or ideas, I don't know how much we want to get into that specifically on the show, but you know, search around on Google, look around, see what people are saying. You know, it's kind of like, is it illegal? I don't know. Is it immoral?
I don't think the NVIDIA police are going to come kicking down your door because they got a report from CS5 that a non-Quadro card was being used to accelerate your rendering.
No, I don't think so.
You know, I think ideally NVIDIA would be able to, you know, they would like to sort of have the, I shouldn't say this. There are some companies that would like, you know, would like things like this to cause their part to sort of melt in its socket and force you to buy an entirely new machine. I will not put that upon NVIDIA. I think they're pretty enthusiast friendly this way, but that's actually there are a lot of we get a lot of email from people who are like, you know, I'm an engineering school or I'm an architectural school. I use these insane programs. I don't have umpteen $1,000s for a workstation, so. Good.
I'd be curious to see if there are if you can buy Quadro cards as a student at some kind of discount. Like, as you know, I get the idea. If you're paying $2,800 for the CS5 production premium suite or something, whatever it is for the whole suite from Adobe, I can understand NVIDIA saying, well, look, if you're going to spend $2,500 on software, spend $2,000 on a graphics card, you're obviously professional, you're making a living at this. It's a once every 2 year investment. But if you're a student, you get the software for $500. It seems unreasonable to pay $2,500 for the hardware to go with it. So I don't know if anybody knows if you can get hardware through any kind of official channels, lower cost, let us know about that too. That would be interesting.
Cool.
We got another email here from Jordan who asks about or tells us about actually a unique dual boot system. We've had this debate for a few weeks. People are asking about how can you use less power on a desktop computer. So he had a unique solution. For a great power-saving option. Take a look at the DFI LAN Party Hybrid P45 Ion T2A2 motherboard. It contains an Atom board and a standard P45 motherboard on the same PCB. It allows you to swap between the two as well. Fairly big power savings there, as an Atom board uses about as much power as a standard processor by itself. There are fairly big caveats in this, but it should provide a good power-saving option. I've never used it, so
this is a $400 board. It's a fascinating idea, right? Because you go to DFI's webpage, and once you get sort of past the exploding shiny graphics and you dig through the product series, right? They call it the multiplex double platform. It's their hybrid series. Provides you with four saves, right? You can drop power consumption by 65%. They say it's 20% less money than other conventional double platforms, and you can operate on both platforms simultaneously, which is kind of bizarre, but it literally is an Atom system. The green platform, which is the NVIDIA Ion plus Intel R-Atom NT30, and the power platform, which is the P45 chipset, this is saying it's supporting Core 2 Duo and Core 2 Quad, so it won't even support. Well, it doesn't seem like it'll support a Core i7.
No, it's a P45 chipset.
Yeah,
so it's Core 2 processor.
I'm fascinated, but I don't know. It seems like so many times when you see a complicated hybrid board like this, because I'm seeing nobody stocking this. There's like one vendor stocking this online.
I think this is more of a good exercise in scientific theory, right? Can we do this? Do you think this is possible? And the answer is yes. Would it be useful at a lower cost with a more modern platform? Yes. The problem is this is very non-standard design, so it takes a lot longer for them to get something like this up and running. It's cool. I would never buy one. I would never integrate one. It says you can swap between the two. I'm not exactly sure what that means. Obviously, you can shut down one and run the other, I guess, is what that is, because I can't imagine you could somehow swap the operating system between them. That would be an incredible feat. Maybe it would be worth $400 if you could somehow migrate your operating system in a virtual way from the P45 Core 2 system to an Atom-based system. I don't think that's possible. And I think I know what Patrick's going to say, that this is too expensive to offset any kind of power savings.
Yeah, I'm sitting there, I'm like, yeah. I want to see one running in Atom mode and Core 2, quad core mode. Take the power difference in terms of kilowatt hours and then calculate it out. I think you're right. Engineering exercise, fascinating. And it seems like one of those motherboards that's just, remember like the combined sort of AGP PCI Express or the combined PCI AGP boards going back a thousand years, where it was a really cool idea because you could buy the common cards now, but you'd still be ready for the next generation of cards. So you could recycle your old generation, your old, bus card. And they never really worked really well. Unless the company really nailed the firmware to the floor. Jordan, very cool find. Thanks for the heads up. I'm not spending, more than I paid for my Core i7 motherboard to save 20 bucks a year, which probably makes me a bad green person that I have to buy more biodiesel. Mike has a question about Crossfire X speeds. He says, hey, I recently purchased another XFX ATI 5770 to cry Crossfire X. Right after I installed the card and put the Crossfire bridge in, it came up in the ATI Catalyst Control Center. I clicked the checkbox to enable Crossfire 10. Is it Crossfire X or Crossfire 10?
Just X, I think.
Crossfire X. But my frame rate still seemed to be the same in all my games. Is there anything else I need to do? Did I do something wrong? So he's got the Crossfire bridge. Has he reinstalled all the drivers? Because that would be my first reaction, is I would want to reinstall my drivers from scratch. I don't know if that's necessary.
I still think he should do that. The driver's obviously installed, though, because the driver wouldn't give you the option to enable Crossfire if it didn't see both cards and recognize that there are two cards in there. There are a couple of things. One, reinstall the drivers. I'd use an application, a tool like Driver Cleaner. Make sure you get everything out, reboot a couple times, run it again, reboot, reinstall the driver there. Also, he didn't really give us any details on like what the games were or what the performance levels were. VSync can have a lot to do with this. It's depending on what game you're playing and what kind of, if you've got a frame rate limiter in the game of 60 frames per second and your 5770 was getting you 55 frames per second and the Crossfire could get you 75 or 80, but because the game is limiting you to 60, maybe that's possible as well.
Definitely you don't want to. One of the frustrating things, and we've talked about this on the show before, is until very, very recently, the boosts that you got out of Crossfire or SLI were incremental, not doubling. Mm-hmm. We were both like, oh my God, there's a freaking dual graphics card setup that actually practically doubles your performance now, because it's always been like 30% here, 50% there was ridiculous and outstanding. Reinstall the graphics driver, run a benchmark, for your favorite video game, or, download FutureMark and run 3D benchmark. Because a lot of stuff like it can be, you can be like, benchmarkers will be like, I got four more frames per second, and that's great, but very few human beings can actually notice a difference. Right. I mean, like 30 frames per second.
Oh. Do we lose Patrick? I think we got a frozen Patrick. We'll try to get Patrick back. But his point was valid. Here's what I would suggest that this user try. Uninstall your driver. Uninstall everything. Have just one card in. Reinstall the new Catalyst 10.8 driver. Once you have that installed, run your favorite game. See what your benchmark numbers are. However you're going to do that. Also, I would install the free version of 3D Mark Vantage. Run that and get a number. It's not useful for a lot of things. It's not a real, drastically important benchmark, I think. Obviously, games are much more important, but it can be a good point of reference, be a good data point. Install the second card, install the drivers, get the software running, enable Crossfire, all that kind of stuff. Then rerun 3D Mark Vantage, rerun your game. If you see a change in the 3D Mark Vantage results, then the driver's working, the two cards are communicating and they're sharing the load. If you're not seeing any improvements in that game, check your game configuration. It could be that game doesn't support multi-GPU very well. Try a different game. Try a couple of different games and see what you get. I think that's the best way to go with that route. Try, start from the beginning, add one card, test, add two cards, test, and we should be good to go. Don't pull the Ethernet cable out is the answer there, Patrick.
Yeah, I'm using a jank Ethernet cable at work that I didn't realize was jank, so I will be disappearing and replacing it with a proper Ethernet cable that still has the little clip on the end. I don't know. I shouldn't mock the Ethernet cable because Ethernet cables
weren't
designed
for so many years.
They weren't designed to be plugged and unplugged and unplugged and unplugged and plugged and unplugged and be played with by people during business calls. Because I've seen people sitting there like working the little tab with their thumb. That's true. Has hit the overclocking wall. He says, I'm running an AMD 1055T. It's stable at 3.5 gigahertz, overclocked for the stock 2.8 gigahertz. I'm unable to get stability from overclocking my system any further. I know that pain. My front side bus is at 250 megahertz, locked multiplier 14x with my NB at a stock 2000 megahertz, RAM a stock 1333 megahertz. When I raise the front side bus any further, my system cannot complete stability testing prime 95 for at least 3 hours. That's a good start. To try and isolate the problem, I've run my RAM at a lower speed with a lower divider, and I've also lowered my Northbridge and HD link speed, but still no dice. I've given my CPU and Northbridge, 1.4 volts to try and stabilize the system, but still no luck. My thermals are excellent. Have I hit the overclocking wall on my CPU, which would be odd as most 1055Ts can reach the glorious 3.8 to 4 gigahertz range, or is my motherboard just not up to the job? It is a MATX, so it could be power phase limitation. Also, I've turned off turbo mode. Memory I've actually found. I don't know. I tend to be really frustrated by memory sometimes when I'm overclocking. Oops. I didn't touch the Ethernet cable. Are you guys still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Sorry.
Oh, there I had it is. My mute button on that time. I read this question and I felt like a 250 megahertz bus speed, base clock speed on that processor is probably pretty high. Right. It says he's got a locked multiplier of 14. So he's reaching what? 3.5, and he says most of them are able to get 3.8 or 4. I think it's very possible that you did hit the overclocking wall of that processor.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is I've always had a theory that as processors get more mature, because, like, you know, processors are bin sorted. They make a whole bunch of processors. They cut them. They mount them. They test them. Or, you know, in some order, they basically test the processor, and based on how stable it runs on AMD or Intel's internal testing, they decide how fast the label on that processor is going to be. And there's been some cases where the label on the processor was, like, you know, grossly undervaluing what the chips could actually run at because they were just particularly efficient or particularly lucky or you know, Spider-Man juice dripped on that particular set of wafers. I've always run at the theory that as processors get older, the really cool fast chips tend to show up less and less often as yields become more effective. That may be a complete, that may be circumstantial evidence. But yeah, I've run into chips where I've gotten much faster than other people, and I've run into chips where I've gotten much slower than what everybody gets.
Yeah.
Because what everybody gets on the boards also may have no bearing into what they can actually run at home stable without their games or their video rendering or, you know, their Blu-ray playback or mm-hmm. you know, goodness help me, their browsers can actually handle.
Right.
And that just is what it is. I'd be pretty happy with 3.5 gigahertz on a stock 2.8 if it's stable. But I also say, like, you know, if you've got a buddy that has a system that has a similar type of RAM, maybe swap the RAM out on that system or you know, you can kind of start isolating parts that way, which helps if you're like Ryan and you have 32 systems and 400 motherboards and several thousand gigabytes of RAM sitting in the workshop. If you don't have that, if you have a really, really supportive friend who will actually loan you the memory to swap into your system, you can start trying to isolate it. But, you know, I'm thinking, you know, you're probably hit the wall on that one.
I personally wouldn't go through a lot more effort to find that extra 300 megahertz. He says something about it being a micro ATX motherboard, and I would say it's not always the case, but in general, micro ATX motherboards do have less engineering put into mind about overclocking potential and that kind of stuff. But do you really want to spend $300 on a new motherboard to test that theory out. $200 on a new motherboard to test that theory out.
This also goes back to
it's one of the things that's hit or miss.
Run some benchmarks. You know, take a look at the performance on you know, something at 2.8 gigahertz and 3.5 gigahertz. And if you're like, oh, you know, my real world performance gain is X plus 300 megahertz really going to be worth the time and pain and frustration?
Yeah. Agreed.
And if it is, man, you know, get some nitrogen and start dosing that board and you can really turn things up. Liquid nitrogen is amazing for overclocking if you can keep it from destroying the motherboard and the chip.
And if you can afford it. We got an email from Andrew about TV tuners. Basically wants to know, what is our recommendation for a good quality TV tuner? Doesn't have cable or anything, so I can't really have a DVR, but with Windows Media Center, I would be able to get more functionality of my computer than I can with a TV. And I look towards Patrick for this as the HD Nation guy. Where should he start looking?
Okay, Windows Media Center, excellent choice. It's one of the things that Microsoft has really, really done well in Windows. And actually, you can turn your computer into DVR because you can have, I'd say that assuming you have HD over the air broadcast in a place where you can reach it. You know, a $20 antenna and a Hopog card can do amazing things. Hopog WinTV HVR 2250 Media Center Kit Dual TV Tuner is kind of the top of the line at a whopping $125. And it's basically has the ATSC ClearQuam and analog NTSC tuners, obviously dead because they've shut off analog. HVR 1600 is $97, includes a Windows Media Center remote. And the HVR 1600 is looking kind of like the sweet spot. And the 2500 is kind of the next step up, and the kind of cool, because, you know, Newegg, Tiger, the rest of them, they sell these bundles where it's the Hopog board, so it's PCI Express interface. You plug your antenna into it, you get a Windows Media Center remote, so that gives you all the cool buttons for Windows Media Center that matches up, and they're pretty bomb-proof. You know, 4 stars on Newegg with 212 reviews for the 2250, 4 stars for like 120 reviews on the HVR 1600. My go-to is almost automatically Hopog. And if you're sitting there, if anybody's at home is looking for a really cool box to capture video, HD video, and they have, obviously you can't capture HD video over HDMI because HDCP blocks it from Blu-ray players. Yep. And yes, your PS3, you cannot capture gameplay off of PS3 over the HDMI port. If you have component outputs, the Hopog HD PVR is a personal video recorder. Max is out at 720p. But for $200, it's a fantastic little interface to capture HD source video. And those WinTV tuner cards should do up through 1080i or 1080p in terms of the capture on that one. Let me double check that real quick. Yeah, but ClearQuam is the HD over the air stuff. That's pretty. There's some really good looking television coming out, especially if you have a good public access PBS station in your area. And if you've got a freaking 2 gigahertz P4 or faster, you'll be pretty good running with that. So that would be my pick, man. Just go straight to Hopog, get the board, run Windows Media Center, let Windows Media Center do, you know, Windows Media Center will do DVD out of the box. You need third-party software for Blu-ray playback. You can actually turn your PC into a DVR with over-the-air. So I would definitely check that out. It can be a lot of fun to see how fantastic over-the-air HD can look. Like, the only thing that can beat that is a really good Blu-ray disc. So,
cool.
That's my call.
All right. How about an email from Ben about 30-inch monitors? He's in the market to buy one, and he's wondering if he should buy now or continue to wait to see if prices come down. He's been watching the market, and it seems like prices have been steady for quite a while now. Would you care to prognosticate as to whether that will change? Thanks. Love the show.
Well, in some ways, they've kind of dropped down already. You know, 30 inches is really tough, right? Because 24-inch, I think, is kind of the high end for the desktops in most corporations. You get to the art department or the video editors or the executives, and you start seeing the 27-inch monitors. 30-inch yeah. monitors is a huge screen to put on your desktop. You know, you're also, I want to say you're probably running, like Dell UltraSharp 3008 WFP. That's 2560 by 1600 resolution. So it's a it's a fairly modest resolution increase for having a much bigger screen, which means your pixels are starting to kind of feel big. And that's a $1,600 part. You know, the 27-inch monitors are still selling for, you know, $1,100. So 27 to 30 inch is still a pretty healthy VIG. You're looking at like it's a $500 gain. It's a 30% gain in price almost. You know, and a 24-inch, nice 24-inch monitors are $259, $340. $500 for the ultra sharp 24-inch monitor.
I don't think 30s are going to come down very much. Mm-hmm. I mean, They're not a high enough volume market for it to really kind of, I mean, we've seen 22s and 24s and even 27s at this point really start to rock it down. You can get nice 19 by 12 or 1080p 24-inch monitors for like $200 now, which is awesome. Which is one of the reasons why NVIDIA Surround and ATI Affinity technology are so compelling for gaming options, because you can get a set of three of those for way under the price of a single 30-inch monitor. Now, don't get me wrong. I love 30-inch monitors. I have lots of them, and I use them all the time. But I would have a hard time paying full retail price for any of them anymore, knowing what I can get in the 22 and 24-inch fields. So.
Yeah, two 24-inch monitors is a huge amount of real estate. If your fear, Ben, is that you're going to spend $1,500 on a 30-inch monitor and come Christmas, they're going to be $800. No, you have nothing to fear there. Personally, you know, I'm with Ryan. You know, for the money, buy two 24-inch panels, put them next to each other, put one, you know, in portrait mode, one in landscape mode, play around with them. There's some really good third-party software that you can sort of customize how Windows interfaces with them. Yeah, buy the 30-inch monitor now, or buy like three 24-inch ultra-sharp monitors for the same money.
Yeah. Definitely agree. All right, we got one more question here. Nope, one or two more.
Vlad. Do you want to do Vlad or
White screen fixes? See. Email from Vlad about Intel HD graphics with discrete graphics. I think we might have covered all that. No, let's see. He just bought a Dell Inspiron 13R something 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 laptop. It comes with an Intel Core i3 350M processor and an AMD Radeon 5470 discrete graphics card. And now his question is, shouldn't this processor also have integrated Intel HD graphics on the die? Could Dell have literally or not cut that out somehow? He asks because every time he tries to install the Intel graphics driver, both from Dell or from Intel, he gets an error message saying the computer doesn't meet the minimum hardware requirements. And just to be clear, he says the ATI graphics works fine, driver installed and all, expecting to have two separate graphics options and a discrete card and integrated solution from Intel. So, do you know the answer to this, Patrick?
I'm actually trying to double check, because it's kind of funny. I thought I was going to be able to upgrade. I have this Dell. I have a couple of Dell Minis, the 10-inch netbooks, and I picked up a Broadcom Crystal HD accelerator card. I'm like, you know, I'm going to drop it into this netbook, and I have this amazing portable HDMI equipped 1080p capable portable home theater, you know, netbook that I can carry around when I'm traveling. And what I found out is that not only did they not have, because I figured it was going to have the extra mini PCI Express slot on the micro PCI Express.
I don't know.
Having a brain fade, basically the little tiny expansion card. And apparently I'm having brain fade. And the space is there for it on the motherboard, but they saved money by not soldering down the mount for it. And so I was sitting there, I'm like, okay, I can probably scrounge one of these to one of the parts suppliers with one of the mounts, and I can do surface mount soldering. I hate doing it, but I can do it. And then I can find out whether or not, you know, the firmware will actually recognize it. And I'm like, okay, I'll crack open the other netbook and see if I find it. But
nice.
It's amazing kind of what driver and firmware configurations can do for access.
Yeah. I think the answer to this question is pretty simple, though. I think Dell just disabled it. They just disabled the Intel graphics because ATI's GPUs don't support any type of hybrid switching or going back and forth between them in software. So, you know, NVIDIA has their Optimus technology, which can do that, switch between discrete and integrated. ATI doesn't really have anything like that right now. So I think they just kind of disabled it because you have a discrete on there. It's going to run fairly low power when it's not in use anyway. So I don't think it's going to affect your battery life too much. But that would be my reasoning for that, I think.
So, yeah.
There you go.
Sorry, dude.
Sorry, Vlad.
Go ahead. We got one last little point to make here for the episode.
Battlefield 2 white screen fixes, the white screen of death. I'm playing and the screen goes white and everything is horrible. One, running driver cleaner to completely start over with the driver software, something we were talking about earlier in the show when somebody installed Crossfire. They're not seeing the improvement they expected from the second graphics card. Again, it's amazing what you can fix by completely uninstalling a driver and reinstalling it. And two, is it possible that the Bloom feature in Bad Company 2 is causing the problem? Turn off Bloom, go to open, documents, BFBC2 settings.ini, open with a text editor like Notepad, change the stock Bloom equals true text line to Bloom equals false. And of course, do this without quotation marks around Bloom equals false. So that's two good suggestions.
We had several people email in. Suggestions for that. Mm-hmm. A lot of these overlap there. Apparently, it is a very, very, very common problem with that particular game. I've never seen it, so I can't comment on any of these fixes. But I figured we would pass along a couple of suggestions that other Twitch listeners and viewers suggested. So that's going to be it for this week. We love getting your questions in. For now, we're still going to ask you to send them to ryan@twit.tv. If you have questions or queries for Patrick and I to bat around here, we love answering the questions, as we like to do on this show. If you want to find me in other places than Twitch, you can find me at PC Perspective, which is a hardware review website, pcper.com. And Patrick, where are those many locations we can find you at again?
Two best places to go is Techzilla, TEKZILLA.com, or Revision3/HDNation, HDNation Home Theater and High Definition All the Time with Robert Herron. And Veronica Belmont is my oh-so-fun co-host on Techzilla, and we basically get our nerd on from cell phones to software to computers to... I don't know why I'm making my head go like this. I'd like to apologize to everyone in the chat right now. I'm going to stop that.
All right, well, that's going to do it for this week. Now, next week, you can watch us, of course, record the show live every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, at live.twit.tv. Obviously, twit.tv/Twitch, TWICH, is the place where you can subscribe in iTunes or Zoom Marketplace, any of those types of locations. Also, next week, we'll have news from the Intel Developer Forum, which will be all early next week in San Francisco, so I'll be able to report on anything interesting that happened there. I'm sure we'll have more than our fair share of news to discuss from there as well. So for that, this has been This Week in Computer Hardware. We'll talk to you next week.
Take care, everybody.